Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today, and I want to say thank you for joining us for the show on this lovely Friday. Coming up a little later in the show, we'll be talking about plastics with Professor David Grewell from the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at ISU. And it's the fourth Friday of the month, so we'll have the Ames Progressive Alliance with us for their monthly segment. But before we get to all of that, you know what's coming up. It's Dennis Hart with the Friday News Roundup.
Thank you, Gail, and hello, everyone. Of course, much of this week's news coverage in the Ames Tribune involved RAGBRAI, the Register's annual great bike ride across Iowa. It was the big story around here, and we will get to it. But first, let's start with a look back at last Saturday's Ames Tribune, which reported that Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley said President Trump's approach to trade makes him nervous, and that he wants Congress to take back some of the authority to regulate the nation's trade practices. In an interview with the Tribune, Grassley said he's trying to comfort his constituents who are worried about Trump putting tariffs on goods from China and other countries. In response, those nations have placed their own tariffs on American exports, such as the corn and soybeans grown right here in Iowa. Saturday's Trib also reported that drivers would have to look for alternate routes starting this past Wednesday when a part of South Duff Avenue would be closed for more than a month. Duff, starting from just south of Airport Road, will be closed for about a mile-long stretch, while workers widen the street, put in new utility lines underneath it, and repave it. It's a $2.5 million project, and while work on the road will continue until next April, Duff will be reopened to traffic before that, perhaps as soon as the end of next month. Residents of the nearby Southdale neighborhood will continue to have access to their homes, as will employees of businesses in the area. Sunday's Trib had a long takeout on the continuing controversy involving the Ames City Council's new zoning standards for Lincoln Way between Duff Avenue and just west of Clark Avenue. Those standards, which the council adopted last month, limit the types of businesses that can be built in that area, including such businesses as vehicle service and repair shops and warehouse businesses. Existing businesses can stay. Council members said the new standards are not designed to force anyone out, but some business owners, well, they're not quite so sure. But those owners are not planning to take any legal action, at least not now, to challenge the zoning. Sunday's Trib also reported that Democratic gubernatorial candidate Fred Hubble came to Ames on Saturday. He spoke at the Story County Democrats' headquarters on Kellogg Avenue, telling those in attendance about the three central priorities of his campaign: education, health care, and income. Hubble faces Republican Governor Kim Reynolds in the November election. And the Trib reported on Sunday on the city's plans to handle the 20,000 or so bike riders who would be riding their way into Ames on Tuesday as part of RAGBRAI. The story detailed the roads that would be impacted and what police planned to do to make sure that everything ran smoothly. It also previewed the entertainment that was in the works Tuesday evening downtown, everything from musical performances to jugglers to stilt walkers, even fire breathers. The Trib does not publish on Mondays. Tuesday's paper reported that an Ames man was arrested last week on a variety of charges, including threatening to shoot a construction worker on the Iowa State University campus and entering a women's locker room. 53-year-old Gregory Arnold Blunt was picked up last Friday and charged with assault, trespassing, harassment, and disorderly conduct. It all began when ISU police received a call about a man who entered the fenced-off job site for the new Student Innovation Center on campus and approached construction workers about a job. Court documents allege that the man, identified as Blunt, grew angry and violent, threatening to shoot one of the workers. Blunt allegedly then went to the state gymnasium, where he went into the women's locker room and started to take off his clothes. A custodian told Blunt to leave. He did, but then he came back in and started shouting obscenities at a woman who was showering in the locker room. Just about that time, police arrived and arrested Blunt and took him away. The Trib had another story about the Innovation Center on Tuesday. This one reported that Iowa State is seeking applicants for the role of facility director at the center. Whoever is chosen will oversee the creation of programs for the new facility, which is scheduled to open sometime in 2020. The center will create a space for students to use innovation and advanced technology in a collaborative environment. In addition to collaboration spaces, test kitchens, and a store to sell products that are made by the students in the center will be part of the new facility, which will have 140,000 square feet. Applications for the director position will be accepted through August 5th. There was more in Tuesday's Trib, including word about Monday night's Ames School Board meeting, where board members unanimously identified a set of priorities for Iowa's 2019 legislative session. Every year, the State Association of School Boards asks school districts to review legislative resolutions and provide the organization with top priorities to pursue. On Monday night, the Ames Board voted to select four priorities focusing on mental health, school funding policy, the statewide penny sales tax for school infrastructure, and property taxes. All of those priorities ask for money in one form or another. Tuesday's Trib also had a report that city officials in Nevada have taken the wraps off a community business district infrastructure improvement plan. About 50 people showed up for a public information meeting, and they found out that 11 blocks in Nevada will be affected from 6th Street from I Avenue to M Avenue and several cross streets. Under the plan, streets and sidewalks are going to be torn out, storm sewers and water mains will be replaced, and new connections for sewer and water service will be brought into each building. The city has set aside $9 million in capital improvement program money to pay for most of this project, which is set to start in 2020 and last through 2021. Wednesday's Trib, sure enough, dominated by news about those 20,000 riders who rolled into Ames on Tuesday for the 46th annual Register's annual Great Bike Ride across Iowa. The first bikers arrived Tuesday morning, and they were greeted by clear skies and temperatures in the low 70s. In other words, perfect weather. They were allowed to ride into Jack Trice Stadium, the first time RagBri ever took riders into a Division I college football stadium. Riders came from all over the U.S. and from around the world. One group came from Florida, Illinois, California, Oregon, and Wyoming. The youngest member of that group was 18, the oldest 70. Another group had members from Boston, Los Angeles, Chicago, Kansas City, and Atlanta. One person came all the way from Brisbane, Australia. And Ames police said everything went smoothly. There were no major problems during the event. There was more in Wednesday's Trib, including word that the U.S. Department of Agriculture is going to spend $12 billion in aid to farmers to offset losses incurred by the Trump administration's trade disputes with various countries. That money will be split between three programs: direct payments to farmers to cover lost sales, food purchases that will likely be given to nutrition programs, and trade promotion to new markets. Iowa State University ag economist Chad Hart said the trade package is a signal from the Trump administration that while it feels pressure from ag groups, it's also doubling down on its tariff policy. Wednesday's Trib also reported that after 26 years in Huxley, Craig Tool is going to move its operations to Ankeny. The business has 250 employees and has three buildings totaling 150,000 square feet in Huxley. Company CEO Todd Sommerfeld said a large part of Craig's workforce is from Polk County, and that much of the company's business comes from there. The company will move to Ankeny sometime in the spring of 2021. And one more note, Iowa Democratic gubernatorial candidate Fred Hubbell made a campaign stop at the Story County Courthouse in Nevada on Tuesday to facilitate a discussion on regional mental health issues. He and his running mate, State Senator Rita Hart, toured the jail facilities and sheriff's office. Improving mental health facilities is a central part of Hubbell's campaign. Thursday's Trib had still more about, you bet, RagBri. The front page story reported that an Ames police spokesman said, in his words, overwhelmingly things went very well during the hours that about those 20,000 riders and their followers were in Ames. The event resulted in only one accident involving a bicycle and a car, and that was the result of the biker crossing a street against a traffic signal. The rider suffered a broken leg. In addition, the police spokesman said several arrests were made Tuesday night, but he did not think they were related to RagBri. And a spokesman for Mary Greeley Hospital said about 20 people received care from the hospital's emergency department. Thursday's Trib also reported that an Ames man has been arrested for allegedly threatening to kill his wife and burn her house down. 53-year-old Jonathan Richard Hazel has been charged with harassment. Police said he sent two separate text messages to his wife, one threatening to kill her, the other threatening to burn her house down with her boyfriend inside it. And Thursday's Tribune also had word that the McFarland Clinic has opened its new $7.6 million clinic in the Iowa State Research Park. The new 20,000-square-foot facility houses optometry, physical therapy, and family medicine practices. This is the fifth office the clinic operates around the city, along with buildings on Duff Avenue and in the east, west, and north parts of Ames. A spokesman for McFarland said doctors in the new office moved their practices from the clinic's older buildings around the city, and that McFarland is now recruiting to fill those vacancies in those offices. In today's Friday's Tribune, word that the first of two finalists being considered to take over as the next fire chief in Ames delivered a public presentation in Ames last night. Former Davenport Fire Chief Lynn Washburn Livingston told a crowd of about 20 people in the city council chambers about her philosophy of continuous improvement and the importance of being engaged with other fire service organizations to stay on top of trends and technology. The other finalist for the job is the Ames Fire Department's interim leader, Rich Higgins. And today's Trib also reports that the city of Madrid refused to fire its police chief last night. The city council there refused to accept a termination letter from Mayor Greg Cruz against police chief Rick Tasler. The vote came after two federal lawsuits alleging misconduct by Madrid police. One of them alleged that Tasler punched a man in the face. And one more note from today's paper, an Ames man has been arrested after he allegedly sent sexual messages to a 14-year-old girl. Authorities said 18-year-old Shane Patrick Sharpenter contacted the girl through Facebook Messenger. And that is your summary of the week's news, a busy week involving RAGBRAI and other things from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart, and as always, Gail, I'm going to be back here on Wednesday with a look at news from the pages of several newspapers outside Ames.
And then again next Friday.
Next Friday, be right here.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Another thing that we've been hearing a lot about in the news lately is plastics. For example, Earth Day 2018 was focused on ending plastic pollution. Plastics became popular and widespread in the 60s, as was memorialized in a scene from the 1967 film The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman.
Ben.
Excuse me. Mr. McGuire.
Ben.
Mr. McGuire.
Come with me for a minute. I want to talk to you. Excuse us, Joanne.
Of course.
Thank you. I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
Enough said. That's a deal.
That was 1967, and now it is 2018, and plastic is everywhere, for better or worse. Starbucks was in the spotlight a few weeks ago for redesigning cups to use less plastic. And Starbucks and other businesses have committed to no longer using plastic straws. And I think most people have seen the photos of the massive plastic islands that exist in our oceans and images of aquatic animals harmed by consuming or being caught in plastic materials. Damage can be done by large items like plastic bags and six-pack rings, as well as by microplastics, which are small pieces of plastic less than 5 millimeters long. One of the problems with plastic, as we will learn from our interviewee in a minute, is that plastic degrades, that is, it breaks down into pieces, but it doesn't break down completely through decomposition. Therefore, we end up with tiny pieces of plastic in our oceans and lakes called microplastics. Shockingly, scientists recently predicted that by 2050, there would be more plastic than fish in the oceans if current trends continued. Thinking about plastics and hearing so much about them in the news, we sought out a local expert on plastics, Dr. David Grewell from the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at ISU. When we say plastic, what do we really mean? What kinds of materials are we talking about?
Well, what we're talking about are organic materials in general that are man-made. So what we end up doing is taking some type of petrochemical feedstock, whether it's ethylene or styrene, and we polymerize those. And what we mean by that is we take these little small chemical blocks, it's like an ethylene, and we stack them together like Lego blocks. And so this makes a long polymer chain. And so these are chemicals that's never been around until man started making them. Now, polymers have been around forever, basically. I mean, we are made of polymers, your hair, your skin. Proteins are polymerized amino acids. Your DNA is a polymer. But polymers in general have been around for a very long time. But when chemists many years ago developed plastics, they were taking these synthetic monomers, these synthetic building blocks, and making them into plastics. And so in general, that's what we mean by plastics, are man-made polymers from synthetic feedstock. And they've been great, right? I mean, you look at what plastics do, the medical industry. We can't imagine some of the things that we can do without plastics in the medical industry. When you go to the grocery store, the bags that you carry out, there's very little amount of plastic in any given plastic grocery bag. But it's incredibly strong. And so these synthetic polymers and plastics do have some great properties. So they've served us very well, but obviously they've also have some downsides to them.
So what are some of the downsides, some of the problems that have been created by plastics?
Well, I think, you know, you've seen it in the news lately. It's the negative impact that these chemicals have on the environment. Because they're synthetic, they're man-made, nature has no way of figuring out how to digest these. So when they go into the environment, they last for a very, very long time. You can break them down with UV, and you see that, you know, put a piece of plastic out into the sunlight. And if it doesn't have UV stabilizers in it, it'll start to turn yellow. It'll become brittle. It'll start to break down. But it's still there to some extent. And then, but what's worse yet is what we're seeing in the ocean plastics. You know, there's these islands, not just in the Pacific, like the one that's in the media a lot, and they're all over the globe, these islands of plastics that are floating, and fish and birds and other, you know, microbes are picking these up. And they're not able to digest them because they are synthetic and they've not been around that long compared to how long the Earth's been around. And so these microbes and animals have no idea how to deal with them, and that's having a huge negative impact on the environment.
I was in Bali last week, and I would get up about the crack of dawn and walk along the beach, and I got all these pictures of the amount of plastics along the beach. Now, by noon, we were at the conference was at a resort, and so the resorts do what they normally do. They got people coming out, you know. When I was out walking, they were showing up and are cleaning it up. So by noon, it doesn't look too bad, but it's coming in at such a rate, they have to walk up and down the beaches continuously, keep the beaches clean. And then in the morning, you know, the trash has had all night to build up. So there's been a lot of studies, and most studies are going to indicate that it is coming from, you know, China, India, where this is blowing off the land and going into the ocean. So that is probably the biggest contributor. The next ones are going to be things like river runoff, stuff getting thrown into rivers, and the rivers feeding in the ocean. And then the last one is probably ocean vehicles of some type. Fishing nets are a big thing. You know, I saw a few of those. So that, you know, there's multiple sources, but wind blown off land is clearly the number one.
One of the areas of research that you're involved in is using plant proteins to make new kinds of plastics that are biodegradable. So these would be still polymers, but made out of different building blocks, so they would behave or last or break down differently. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So many years ago, I had a student from Bill Graves' department come over and talk about, hey, you've been working with protein-based plastics, and he had the idea of making pots for, like, gardening pots out of protein, because they would, one, degrade their protein, and secondly, they would have high nitrogen content so they could self-fertilize. So this was a great idea, and we went through a number of different iterations until we were able to get a formulation that worked. And so these pots are now manufactured out of Minnesota. It's a company called Self Eco, and you can buy these on Amazon as well as in Walmart. But the big benefit, or one of the other benefits that came out of this, is something that we did not foresee. So I grew up on a farm, and if anybody does gardening, when you go and you get your tomato plant, whether it's on Main Street here on Saturday morning and you go home and plant it, when you pull the root ball out of the plastic, the very first thing you do is you take the root ball and you start to unwind the roots, because they do this root circling where they trace around the circumference of the pot. In our case, when you plant a tomato plant or a pepper plant or whatever it is into one of our protein-based pots, the root circling is inhibited. We're not really fully understanding why that is, but it stops the root circling, and in response, the root ball produces a large number of root nodules, and they're all pointing outward in a radial direction. And so the plants that are potted in one of these pots are actually quite a bit healthier, and we see about a 200% increase in the yield of fruit, so twice as much peppers, twice as much tomatoes. And so what that means is now you get a pot that when you go and buy your tomato plant, you dig the hole, you pull the pot off the root ball, and you have not had to add any fertilizer to it, because the plant is getting the fertilizer from the protein, the nitrogen, directly from the pot. We recommend that you crush the pot at this point, so you go ahead and put it into the dirt. We don't recommend that you would plant the whole pot into the dirt, because it would still take some time for it to break down, and we don't want to do anything that would inhibit or slow down the growth of that root ball. But the pot still has some fertilizing effect, so you crush it, you put the debris into the hole, and put the tomato plant on top. And so now you've kind of got a win-win all around, right? So you got a bio-based, which is good, biodegradable, it breaks down in the soil, self-fertilizing, and on top of that, it stops root circling. Jim Schrader spearheaded a book on this. You can go out and buy an entire book on this topic and learn about how the whole technology works.
Do you think that things like plastic bags at supermarkets might someday be made out of biodegradable plastics like this?
You know, we have seen a fair amount of that. But, you know, when you talk about biodegradability, this is something that I talk quite a bit about, and it's not always received as well as what I thought it might be. And that the biodegradability is not necessarily the end solution of a lot of plastics. I think that there's a number of end-of-life treatments for plastics. I mean, clearly the first thing is recycle. Recycle, reuse, repurpose, whatever you can do to extend the life, particularly if it's a petrochemical plastic where you've put a lot of energy in recovering the feedstock, whether it's oil or natural gas, shipped it, synthesized it, you know, purified it, polymerized it, and so on. And so anything you can do to reuse, repurpose, and so on, the three R's is probably your best choice. And then, you know, at one point, though, the product probably it does have to go away in some fashion. And so we could have a couple different options. One, right, you could throw it into the ground and hopefully it would decompose in some way, whether it's accelerated by sunlight or microbes or hydrolysis where water introduces itself into the backbone. And then it lands up coming into carbon dioxide and so on. But that may not be the best solution. You know, here in Ames, we have a trash burning facility. And so plastics are, and even bio-based plastics, are hydrocarbon-based. And so if we were to burn them, we release it back to carbon dioxide. But on top of that, we've captured the energy. Now, you can do this in a couple of different ways. You could do like we did here in Ames, where we just directly burn these some of the plastics, and it has to be done correctly such that it's safe to the environment. You don't want to be releasing dioxins and so on. And so now you've gotten rid of the plastic. You've captured the energy, and that seems like a very viable solution. You could rely on anaerobic digestion where you produce methane gas, capture the methane gas, and then burn that. So, you know, just being biodegradable is probably not the only solution that we should be looking at in terms of getting rid of plastics. But I do want to emphasize the fact that, you know, the in-between stage of reusing, repurpose, and so on has to really be considered.
And some people are also concerned with chemicals that can leach out of plastics when they're used in, say, for example, water bottles and other food kinds of containers. Do you see these new kinds of plastics eliminating or reducing those concerns?
Well, you know, even with bioplastics, we do put additives into these. You know, the big one that you're probably talking about are PBAs that were in polycarbonate as an additive for a couple of different reasons. And yeah, those were leaching out and they were emulating hormones and causing a number of different health issues. And the industry's become aware of that and they've reduced that, if not eliminated it. When we say bioplastics, I don't know that we can conclusively say that nobody's going to put additives in. When you make these plastics, that people are going to put stuff in there to enhance their mechanical properties, to enhance their manufacturability. Inherently, when you manufacture PLA, let's say, you know, there probably would not be any residual chemicals in those, but what people would add to those as a manufacturer, you want to make parts faster, you want to make parts cheaper. You know, there's no way for us to absolutely say that that's going to eliminate it.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI. We're speaking with David Gruwell about plastics. Dr. Gruwell is the director of the Center for Bioplastics and Biocomposites, also known as CB Squared, which fosters collaboration between industry and research on plastics and issues related to them. I asked him to tell us about one interesting project that has come out of this center at ISU.
This is kind of a funny story. Two of our member companies, Ford Motor Company and Hyundai, are interested in lightweighting cars, right? They want to get the weight of the car down in order to get the efficiency up, get the miles per gallon up. And then we had another company, Diageo. And Diageo is a large alcohol producer, and not for fuels, not like Lincoln Way Energy here or REG, but they produce alcohol for human consumption. And one would not think that you would have Diageo being interfaced well with Ford Motor Company, right? You don't want to normally have automobiles and drinking alcohols combined. But Diageo does make tequila. And when you get done making tequila, you have agave fibers. And what we've been able to show is that you can take agave fibers and compound those with plastics and have a material that has a very high specific strength ratio compared to traditional composites. So typically in the automotive industry, they add glass fibers to plastics in order to increase their stiffness, increase their strength. But glass fibers have a couple disadvantages. One, they're relatively heavy. They have a high density. And secondly, they're relatively brittle. The agave fibers are not as strong, but they are relatively flexible. And so when you run them through a manufacturing facility, going through extruders, going through injection molding machines where they have to go around tortuous corners and rather tight flow patterns, they will not break, unlike glass fibers. On top of that, the agave fibers are relatively light. You put a piece of glass fiber in water, it sinks. You put a piece of agave fibers in water, and it floats. So its density is relatively low. And so what happened is we've been able to show that you can get about a 15 to 20% weight reduction in agave fibers from tequila production, put that into a car, and have that savings compared if it was just a traditional glass composite. And we have also shown that there's energy savings associated with that as well. So it's not just that the car sees a benefit as in terms of miles per gallon, but there's reduced cycle times. It's easier to make these parts. There's less energy that goes into them. So even like for Ford Motor Company and Hyundai, they have a savings and a reduction in greenhouse gases at the production facility.
Based on your experience in this field, what do you think the future is? I mean, do you think the future is going to be improved in terms of plastics everywhere in the environment and the negative impact that they are having?
Yeah, I mean, you already see it, right? California, a number of states are looking to outlaw straws. I'm not sure if that's necessarily the form I would gravitate towards. I mean, you go down along the beach and you do see straws along the beach line, but it's probably the number four, number five in terms of what the plastics are. It's more the trash bags, it's more candy wrappers, it's more food packaging and so on that's out there. But hey, if straws is what's able to get us to the point where we start to regulate and start to think as from a societal point that plastics need to be carefully monitored. We need to reduce them. The other R that's in the equation of reducing the amount of plastics we use because they just naturally do not break down.
Are there specific recommendations you would make for Ames or for the university in terms of their policies and approaches to dealing with plastics?
Well, I think, it does come back, trying to reduce. If we look at the food packaging industry, it's probably our biggest. You know, just the other day I was over on Duff and looked out into one of the cornfields and it was just fully covered with, wind-blown trash bags and wind-blown grocery bags and so on. And so if anything we can do, and I think it's great that when you come to the farmer's market on Saturday, they're handing out, the reusable bags. They're plastic, but they're reusable. And so anything that we can do to reuse plastics, whether it's the bag, whether it's to go to compostable or degradable utensils on campus or across town during events. There are actually even within the Big Ten, and I know that other conferences are doing it, they have a competition during football games, during sports events, to see who can use the most sustainable cutlery, the most sustainable amount of plastics that's used in terms of sustainability of what could be reused or recycled or just based upon corn or whatever. There is a huge amount of education component brought to it. I'm on the board of directors for the what used to be called SPI or Society of Plastics Industry, now just called Plastics. And one of our major efforts is to help educate the public, is to inform them about what's it mean to be biodegradable, what's it mean to be compostable. These are two different terms, and making sure that people understand what that means. What's it mean to be sustainable? What's it mean to be bio-based? Is it 100% bio-based? Is it 10% bio-based? And so the USDA has done a good job through that of defining what that means through the bio-preferred program. And so, I think that there's some efforts out there, but, trade associations like plastics and so on can help accelerate that.
Anything else that you would want to share with us about your work or what people should know about plastics?
Well, I don't think that we can, go out and say that plastics are bad, right? I mean, I tried to emphasize the fact that they're around us, everything we touch. And I look around the room here, probably 90% of what I'm looking at are plastics to some extent, whether it's the varnish on the wood or it's the clock or it's the paint on the metal or the headphones and so on. So they've served us very well. But if we can just be aware of how these materials are affecting the environment and try to be aware of trying to reduce our use and trying to look at what can we do in terms of using sustainable materials and then making sure that once we're done with a plastic component, we consider about how we want to, you know, take care of its end of life. Do we want to have it be biodegradable? In some cases we do, or do we just want to be able to do what we do here in Ames to, for the most part, and burn these and capture the energy and turn on the lights with it?
This is Local Talk on KHOI. We've been listening to Dr. David Grewell from the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at ISU, and he's been talking with us about plastics. Now we're turning to some guests that have magically appeared in the studio. We have our monthly visit from the Ames Progressive Alliance. So I'll welcome Ann Kinzel. And Betty Baird is in the background somewhere, and I'm going to let you introduce our topic and the guest for today.
Thanks, Gail. Good morning, everybody. The APA is going to welcome Barb Wheelock this month. Barb is an Ames native who just retired at the end of May from a long career as a physical therapist. Morning, Barb.
Good morning.
So before we get going, I have to ask one thing. I understand you're a runner.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes,
yeah.
I am.
So you run marathons?
I do. I've been running marathons since about 2000.
Wow. How many marathons have you run?
I've run 56 marathons so far.
So would that be like every state plus something else?
So my husband and I did the 50 states. There's a club you can join, and you do a marathon in each state. And so we were able to do it together, so it was really a fun thing to do. We could travel together and have that experience together. So
I think everybody gets the idea that this is going to be a woman who's active in retirement,
right? Yes, that's a plan.
That's going to keep running?
Uh-huh. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So today we're going to explore two important themes with Barb. We're going to talk about her thoughts on retirement and her new passion as a community/political activist. So according to the Social Security Administration, Americans can now expect to live at least 20 years after retirement. In fact, my dad just turned 95, and he's 33 years post-retirement, which is longer than his career ever was as a university professor. I think this is something really important to think about. We have a whole second, maybe third life now facing us after we retire. So the question is really, how can we live vibrant lives, contribute to our communities as we age, and leave the workforce? And this is an important conversation for Ames and communities across the country. So let's start it today with Barb. So Barb, how many years did you work as a physical therapist?
I 27 years.
27 years.
Yeah.
And what did you do before that?
I had various jobs. So I didn't go to college right out of high school. So I had some jobs, industrial jobs, worked at the animal disease lab, that kind of thing, before I went back to college and got my degree in physical therapy.
So for you, it's truly you're heading into a third stage of your
absolutely.
Life. So when exactly did you retire?
May 31st. So I retired on a Thursday, and the following Monday I took off on a 2.5-week vacation with some friends and my husband, which I highly recommend to people.
It's not a vacation anymore.
Well, that's right. That's what somebody else told me. It's a trip now.
It's a trip. All right. So before you actually retired on the 31st of May, when did you start thinking or planning about a post-retirement life?
I would say it was maybe 3 years or so before I actually retired. I had a really good friend who had retired. My sister had retired. I told everybody that would listen that if I could retire, I'd do it in a heartbeat. And then our financial planner said, well, Barb, I don't know why you can't retire. And I went, oh, you know, kind of took my breath away because to think about it and then to actually have it be a reality is something different.
So you started about the process lasted about 3 years before you finally made the final decision.
Yep.
And what kind of thoughts or emotions went through you in those 3 years? Did it change as it got closer, or how did that work out?
So, well, initially I was surprised that when I found out I could retire that it was a scarier prospect than what I had thought. But I was really lucky that I could gradually decrease the number of days a week I worked. So I went from 4 days a week to 3 to 2. So that that helped transition me out. I saw how easy it was to start filling my time with other things. It just kind of magically happened. So, yeah.
The magic retirement. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So what kind of emotions did it, as a physical therapist, you're a professional. That's an identity.
Yeah,
how
definitely.
How did that work?
Well, I found the first time after retirement that I met somebody and the question is, what do you do? And my response is, I'm a physical therapist. And I kind of stopped midway because it's like, well, I'm not really now. I mean, I am, but I'm not. Mostly it's been exciting. I mean, it's, but there's been some times where I'm going, what am I going to do next?
So
those are brief.
Are you going to be volunteering in your former profession? Will you? How do you stay? Will you stay connected with it?
Actually, so we have to renew our license every 2 years. So I just renewed my license. So I will continue doing some PRN work, probably for at least another couple of years. At least that's what I think now.
So for the rest of us, what does that PRN thing mean?
That means as needed. So
as needed.
Yes. So if somebody's sick or on vacation and they need somebody to help, they'll give me a call. And then I have the option of saying, yes, I'll work or no, I won't.
And how does that feel? Does that seem kind of strange or?
No. I mean, I'm going to be interested in seeing if when I get a call, if I actually really do want to work then.
So do you have to do continuing ed?
Yes, if I'm going to renew my license in another 2 years. And I'm not sure I'm going to do that. I'll see. I've got some
time.
So
if I ask you, are you a physical therapist? What are you going to say?
I'm a retired physical therapist.
Oh, okay. All right. I get it. Now, I know that you're a very active woman, as we talked at the beginning. So as you were planning for your retirement, did you consciously think of things you were going to do? Or did you just leave this sort of an open-ended thing?
It was more open-ended. I never anticipated that I'd have trouble filling my time. Like I said, I love to run. I like to be active, bike. I love to garden. So I never really thought specifically what I was going to do to fill my time. I just was confident that it would.
Okay. Well, a little disclaimer here. Barb and I have been friends for a long time, so I've kind of seen her journey towards political activism and community work. So let's talk a little bit more about that. During your retirement planning, is this something that you thought you would get into?
No.
So how did it happen?
After the 2016 election. I mean, I had done some things prior to that, knocked on doors for candidates, that kind of thing. But I was really motivated after 2016 to get more involved.
Okay. So at what point did you really decide to become more active in the progressive community? And you said the 2016 campaign, but did you do anything before that or did you just really launch in after that?
Well, like I said, I did a little bit before that, but I think that really spurred me on, the 2016.
Now, did you get any kind of training or did you just launch yourself? What'd you do?
Well, it started with the Ames Progressive Alliance had a community meeting, Inclusive Ames, and that's kind of where it started. I went to that meeting, which was pretty amazing. There were over 300 people there, and they were just trying to help people focus and find a direction in how they could get involved in the community and help work to make our community as inclusive and diverse as possible, and that started
it. So you became a real Inclusive Ames person.
Yes, I did.
So tell us a little bit about Inclusive Ames for those of our listeners who are not familiar with that.
So it started with that initial meeting, and there were three kind of areas that the APA had laid out for people to work on, and I joined the group that was looking at the community and how we could facilitate diversity in our community. And I can't remember exactly. There was one that was going to work with the schools, and that actually ended up having a new community group that grew out of that. And what Inclusive Ames has kind of ended up being, there were probably six or eight of us who about six, 7 months after that initial meeting got together and said, we don't want to see this go away. We want to see it continue. And so we've continued to work to try to bring educational programs to the community. So
as you got involved in Inclusive Ames, What kind of things did you learn about being involved in the community?
What did I learn?
Yeah. Was it fun? Was there something that surprised you? What did you learn?
That it's very motivating and energizing to work together with a group. And I think I learned I could do more than I thought I could do.
Like I'm doing this. Okay.
I've always thought of myself as a follower versus a leader. And I think I'm starting to recognize that I maybe do have the capacity to step up and help organize a group and lead a group. Well, Camp Wellstone really helped with that.
So. What's Camp Wellstone?
It's a Paul Wellstone foundation, and it provides educational opportunities for people that are interested in getting involved at different political levels, running a campaign, being a candidate, being a community organizer. And a good friend told me about the opportunity to go to Camp Wellstone, and so I went to the community organizer track. And
now, Senator Wellstone, he was the senator from Minnesota who was killed in a plane crash.
Yes.
So
yes.
This is his legacy, I think.
Yes, yes.
So tell us, what did you learn at Camp Wellstone? It sounds like a bunch of adults going to camp, but I suspect you didn't sit around a fire. So,
actually, it was really motivating to be around a large group of people like that were very motivated to have a political impact. Probably the biggest thing I learned in the organizing track is to take things in bite-sized pieces. To take small steps is productive. It advances you towards the goal, but it still keeps everybody energized and excited if you have successes versus if you, you know, do this grand gesture that is not successful, then that can be kind of discouraging. So
how did your Wellstone training play into Inclusive Ames? How did that help you?
I think it helped me when we were focusing on how we were going to move forward as Inclusive Ames. That's to be an inclusive community is a pretty huge thing. And so we were able to kind of look at what we could do and what small piece we could do to move that forward.
Okay. I'm going to ask you some more questions, but I'm going to give us our little station break right now. I want to thank our host, KHOI Radio, Community Radio 89.1. And you're now tuned to KHOI Community Radio 89.1. This is Local Talk, and today is the monthly Ames Progressive Alliance show with our guest, Barb Wheelock. So you mentioned Inclusive Ames earlier and an inclusive community. So I'm curious, what does an inclusive community mean to Barb Wheelock?
Where everybody feels welcome.
And you think that was something that doesn't exist in Ames, does exist? Are we on that?
I think it does exist, but I think there's always opportunities to open our eyes a little wider and see things from someone else's perspective. It's easy for me as a longtime Ames resident, white person, to think, yeah, this community is very inclusive and welcoming, but how does that feel to somebody else that's new to the community or from a different country? So
now Inclusive Ames has held a number of events. Tell us a little bit about those events and how you think they move the ball forward towards an inclusive community.
Well, I think it gave people the opportunity to learn some skills to help them see the world maybe from a little bit different perspective. And we actually, if I can talk about a couple of the events
yes.
that we have coming up, in September 22nd, we're going to have a program, Cross-Cultural Communication, Navigating Difficult Conversations. Dr. Teresa Cooper is going to do that event for us. And then October 20th, we're going to have a program called Compassionate Self-Communication, How to Create a Solid Foundation for Interpersonal Dialogue. And Dr. not doctor, but Mary Nimute is going to help us with that. We're really lucky in Ames to have the Iowa State University as a resource and the Ames Public Library. A volunteer group like us would have a really hard time putting on these events if we didn't have the support of those organizations.
So these events will be held at the public library?
Yep. So you'll be able to go to the public library event page and read a description of the program and when the program is, and no registration required, just come and enjoy.
So tell us a little bit more what you think will be happening at these events. What's the name of the first one again? It was a long title.
It's a very long title. It is Cross-Cultural Communication, Navigating Difficult Conversations. And so there's going to be a skills component, I guess, is what I would say. So they'll give us some education, some information, and then people will be able to have an opportunity to practice some of the.
And that's on September 22nd. And what time is that?
September 22nd, 10 a.m. till noon. And then the other program is on October 20th, 10 a.m. to noon, Saturday mornings.
At the Ames Public Library.
Yep.
And do people need to register beforehand show up?
Just show up. No registration required.
Now, at past events, a lot of people say these kind of events preach to the choir. How do you bring people in? Maybe people who think this is not that important. How do you publicize these events?
That's a really good question. And that's one that we're still struggling with. So doing things like this helps. Having the library is a great resource because they have their community calendar. We've tried putting posters up. The Ames Tribune did a little article. But again, this is – so obviously we'd love to have hundreds of people there, and that's not exactly what happened. But then we looked at, okay, at least we're taking baby steps. So some people got to go to a really good program. Hopefully they'll talk about it and it'll grow from there.
So tell us, you're really active here with Inclusive Ames, but I suspect that if you have the energy to run 56 marathons, that's not the end of the story as far as your progressive involvement in the community right now. What other things are you doing?
I am involved with a group called Flip It Iowa that I'm really excited about. It's a grassroots organization that started in Iowa City. It was a group of people who, again, after the 2016 election, decided that they wanted to do more. And Iowa City is a strongly Democratic district, and so they felt they could still support their candidates but also reach into other districts to help other Democratic candidates. So they collected data. They found about 20 different districts that they thought with good support they could make a difference in the Iowa House, and their goal is to turn the Iowa House blue.
I see. And so what kind of activities does Flip It do?
So mainly it's fundraising, because whether we like it or not, money is really important in our elections. And so raising funds for these candidates is really important. So it's really fun. You have a party and you invite your friends and the candidate comes and you get to hear what these people are hoping to do for us and what motivated them to step up and run for office.
And so they come from all over Iowa.
Yes. So like I said, they pick 20 districts and most of them are there's several in the Des Moines area. There's some in the eastern part of the state. House districts. So here in Ames, we had an event for David Weaver, who is, I can't remember the district number, but it's partly Boone, Greene County. Kristen Sundy, who's down in the Des Moines area, and then for Nancy Fett, who comes from the Dubuque area. We're really reaching out.
So you're having parties. You sound like you live an interesting retirement life. So you run, you do fun things, you have parties.
Uh-huh.
Maybe I need to consider retiring one of these days.
Uh-huh. It's a good thing.
It's a good thing? Okay. Let's go back to Inclusive Ames and the Ames Progressive Alliance for a minute here. You say you have fun. Now, I hear a lot of people, I'm not going to suggest that you're strange, but a lot of people who think that going to meetings and stuff like that for politics isn't fun, and it'd be the last thing that they wanted to do. So what makes it fun for you?
I think, well, for Inclusive Ames specifically, I think it's the group that I'm working with. We just all really click, and we set some parameters for ourselves. The meetings go an hour. That's it. And that's helpful. It keeps us focused and on track. And we are doing things in bite-sized pieces, so it doesn't feel too overwhelming. So for us, that's what makes it work. Yeah.
So is this what you thought you would be doing?
You look amazed, Dan. No, it's not.
What did you think you would be doing?
I thought I'd be running and gardening and biking and, you know, getting this politically active was not a planned deal. It just happened.
It just happened.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So before we end, I'm going to put you on the spot. I want to know what's the most important thing you've learned and you can share with our audience now that you've been retired almost 3 months.
That it's not something to be afraid of. I mean, it sounds really trite, but it really is a new phase of your life. And sometimes that's scary because we can see what it is we're leaving behind, but we can't quite see yet what's ahead. Like the political thing just happened for me. I didn't envision that. And yet it's a really important piece for me in retirement. So I think I've learned that there's things out there that I don't even know yet about myself and what's coming. So that's exciting.
So you truly are exploring a third stage of your life.
Yep, absolutely.
Wow. Okay, so I'm going to be a little less scared about retirement because I've been here with Barb Wheelock this morning. I want to thank Barb for coming in. She didn't have to go to work this morning, so this is a good thing. But our time today is short, and living a vibrant post-work life is such an important topic. I want to thank you, Barb, for getting the discussion started here and for being an active member of the Ames Progressive community.
Oh, thank you, Anne.
May I ask if there are websites or places where people can get information on those two events in particular?
Yes, you can go to inclusiveames@gmail.com, and it's all lowercase. And if you want to learn more about Flip It Iowa, again, that's flipitiowa@gmail.com. And they also have a website, www.flipitiowa.net.
Thank you very much, Anne and Barb. It was a very interesting conversation. Not what I expected, but interesting.
Well, thank you.
In a very good way.
Well, the Ames Progressive Alliance really is pleased to be able to have this spot and talk to progressive members of our community about what they're doing and what their lives are all about.
This was a perfect opportunity and a perfect example of that. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. I want to remind our listeners of two upcoming events. On the afternoon of August 12th, KHOI will celebrate its sixth year of operation, sixth year of on the air. So we always have a birthday party, and there'll be more details on that coming out, but it will be the afternoon into the early evening of Sunday, August 12th. So look for more information on that. There's always good music and good times at that event. Also, starting today is Rummage Rampage, which is a place where you can donate or buy used household items and furniture. And that takes place over on Hayward at the, what's the name of that building there? The parking garage. It has a different name. Intermodal facility. Thank you very much. I couldn't remember the name of it. So that's where it is. And you can drop off things. You can go and pick up some good things to purchase. And all part of reusing and recycling materials, which was something that our plastics expert talked about today as well. If you value the stories and interviews we bring you on Local Talk, please become a member. You can do it online. Just go to the website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button or call 515-292-2878. If you enjoyed today's show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The farmers market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment.